You're listening to Rendezvous with the Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to Rendezvous with the Writer, where readers and writers meet, and story is everything. We're your hosts tonight, Jim and Bobby Bell. You've just been listening to Hot Texas, but Hot Texas Rhythm Man.
And they are out of Texas, and we're so delighted to have you join us. This is episode 176.
Is that what it says? 176.
And we are so happy. This is your first time. We're delighted to have you with us. If you come on regularly, thank you for joining us. And you can always get these after the show, immediately after, on YouTube. And you can also catch us on LA Talk Radio's Facebook page, Rendezvous with a Writer Facebook page. So you can watch it again and again and share it with your friends.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. So, Jim, where are we broadcasting from tonight?
Where are we? I'll tell you. We're in Southeast Texas in a place called The Thicket. I'm not sure how we got here, and internet service may be spotty. It's like we are in a deep jungle with a lot of mosquitoes, snakes, some really strange people.
And snakes.
But my real concern is that old woman in the cabin.
Oh, Jim, who is joining us in the thicket tonight?
James Wade.
Hello, James. Where are you tonight? Are you in the thicket or somewhere else?
Hey, guys. I am not in the thicket tonight. I am in Central Texas, just outside of Austin, at the beautiful Doby Paisano Ranch. It's about 250 acres owned by the University of Texas at Austin, and I'm privileged enough to be staying in the Doby Paisano cabin as part of a writing fellowship that I'm doing this spring.
That is so fun. Yeah. Yes, we're liking what we see behind you. It looks like a wood wall, and then is there a map? What is that?
Yeah, that's a topo map of the Big Bend region. And then this wall, it's been patched a million times, but some of this wood is original from the 1850s when the first cabin was built on this property, about 100 years before J. Frank Doby bought the property. And it's like living in a museum, y'all. I'm not kidding. Some of the stuff that's in here, I ought to pick up the computer and walk y'all around. But yeah, they've got just so many cool artifacts and such such rich history of Texas literature. I mean, J. Frank Doby is, you know, kind of considered the godfather of Texas literature and even of Southwestern literature, and some of the, you know, manuscripts and notes and, you know, different like framed handwritten notes from writers that have been here over the years. This residency started in the 1960s. So it's pretty cool, man. I'm not going to lie. I kind of pinch myself every morning when I wake up.
There you go. There you go.
So do you imagine a book down the road, like if these walls could talk?
Absolutely. I think I think just about everybody that has spent time here has written something about it on the nonfiction side. But I'm definitely keeping my eyes and ears open for, you know, just for little snippets of something that might make it into a novel someday.
Oh, yeah. So speaking of novels, congratulations. Yes. This book that we are going to be taking a good in-depth look at tonight, and we're going to gush over it, so don't be surprised, James, when we gush, is Narrow the Road. And it just was named a finalist for the 2026 Spur Awards in Historical Novel. So congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Do you want to ask him how he got the news?
Yeah, that's a question we ask once. How did you get the news?
You know, Bob Yoho called me and let me know, and I'm such a fan of Bob. He runs the overall Spur Awards, and guys, what a heavy lift, right? To have to manage all those categories, all those entries, all those judges. And yeah. I don't know how he does it, but he does it so well year in and year out. And I just have the utmost respect for him. And honestly, when he called, I just assumed I had messed up on my judging because I judge a different category. Yeah. And I thought, oh God, I've let him down. And, but no, he was calling to give me some good news. And, the winner in my category, Arkansas Black. Oh my goodness. I had the opportunity to read, that novel early and give it a blurb, and it was just tremendous. And I feel like I'm in good company and everything. And I love being a part of the WWA and being part of the Spur Awards. And so anytime you can win one or get a finalist, it's a good day.
Yeah. Yeah, we were excited. You know, to those of you that don't know, the Western Writers, the Spur Award is released. The list comes out on the Saturday of the Tucson Book Festival. I think you may all that are named maybe get the news a little bit sooner, but the public, we all get it on that Saturday. And I was kind of waiting for Bob's email. I've been blessed to be a judge in the song category. This was my second year. And so I was curious, because even the judges, we submit, but we don't know.
That's right. Yeah. I was doing the same thing. I was like, you want to know if your pick made it in, if it won or made it into the finalists. Yeah. I'm always, because you listen to these songs or these albums, you read these books, and they become a little bit of a part of you, and you have your favorites, and you want to see them do well and see the artists get recognition and everything.
Yeah.
So I'm always happy if somebody that's on my list actually gets, a finalist or wins a Spur.
2 years ago, we went to the Tucson Festival for the first time. Yeah. And many of the people that we knew as we were going from booth to booth had gotten the news, they knew it was gone out that morning. And it was so fun. We were in the gold medallion booth, the Will Rogers medallion booth. And I think Preston Lewis had just learned that particular year that he was a winner or a fine. It was so fun. We were going from booth to booth and people like, hey,
You didn't see anybody was unhappy because they didn't win.
No, we didn't. I can't say that was part of our experience. Anyway, we have so much to talk about because this is the most amazing book. I'm going to hold it up again. Narrow the Road, James Wade. Yeah. It is one of a number of books that he's written, and you will want them all. But this is the one we're going to talk about tonight. Jim, you want to give us a little intro?
We have a short intro here. James Wade is currently serving as the 2026 Adobe Baiano Fellow at the University of Texas at Austin, and that's where he is right now, more or less in that cabin. His latest novel, Narrow the Road, won the 2026 Western Heritage Award for Outstanding Novel. James is the youngest novelist to win two Spur Awards for the Western Writers of America and a recipient of MPIBA's Reading the West Award. His debut novel, All Things Left Wild, was listed as one of the most influential Westerns of the 21st century by True West Magazine. And there's much more.
And there's so much more.
Which we'll get to.
Oh, my goodness. So I'm going to just take a moment and say, as I said the other night when we chatted, that this book, we could not put it down. It is, I don't even know how to describe it. You're going to hear tonight as we kind of dig into it, but it is a multi-level story, complex and simple at the same time. And have water available if you're reading it, no matter what time of the day or night, because you're going to go through an amazing landscape and you will get thirsty. There will be parts where you might want to leave the light on, but not necessarily, because James is such a lyrical writer. Your prose it needs to be read aloud. I kept wanting to say to Jimmy, listen to this. And there's a bit of philosophy. There's environmental commentary. There's anything and everything, I think, James, under the sun. And you do it so masterfully.
That is just, I mean, my goodness. Yeah. The check's in the mail. That's too kind. I really do appreciate it. But, I feel like 99% of a writer's life is just being alone at a desk. And so to get feedback like that, it really does mean the world. And I really appreciate it, guys. I mean, I know y'all, what are y'all reading, a book or two a week? I know y'all are well read, and so to hear that from y'all, just it really means a lot to me, and I appreciate it.
Well, I'm eager to get into all the others, James, and somehow I'm going to figure out how to read at the same time, because I want to know all of your work. This is just extraordinary.
Yeah. When did you start writing?
Yeah, tell us a little bit about that.
I started taking fiction writing pretty seriously, I would say, in about 2015, 2016. I had worked as a journalist right out of high school for many years in East Texas. And really, I had wanted to write fiction since I was a little kid. But growing up in East Texas, rural part of the state, we didn't have authors coming in the classroom. I didn't know a lot about the publishing industry. It seemed like that's something that happened in New York a million miles away. And so as I got a little older, and I kind of had a little bit of a rough upbringing. And as I got older, the practical side took over. And I thought, well, you know, I don't think I can be a writer because I don't really know what that is. But I do know some folks that work at the newspaper. And maybe I can write that way. I did journalism. I did newspaper writing. It was all right. It never really scratched that creative itch. Mm-hmm. But I did like being involved in the community and reporting on the news and all those things. But that led me into a whole different line of work. I ended up covering elections and politics, and then kind of got into the political world in Texas, which is, you know, as y'all know, the political world is a terrible place to be. And so I ended up working at the state capitol, and then was a lobbyist for a little while. And I always have to caveat that by saying I was a lobbyist for water conservation and public education, right? I wasn't trying to get kids to smoke cigarettes or whatever. You know, lobbyist has a really bad connotation. But I was a lobbyist for some good stuff, I think. And we, worked hard on natural resources and protecting, water rights and everything here in Texas. So did all that. And really, I just kind of felt like there was just something missing. As corny as that sounds, there was just kind of a part of me that wasn't fulfilled, and I was working all the time, and my wife was working all the time, and she came to me one day and said, well, what if we just gave everything up and gave away all of our stuff and just hit the road? And so that's pretty much what we did. We rented a little storage closet for a few things that we couldn't part with, and other than that, we gave away all of our stuff, and we've been living in Austin for close to 10 years, and we left and pulled a little 144 square foot travel trailer across the country. And that's when I wrote my first novel. And I had written a few short stories, you know, in the years prior, but that was when I really, you know, kind of had the time to dig into the craft of writing. You know what I mean? I had been a reader for a long time, and I thought that I knew what good writing looked like or sounded like. But in terms of actually, you know, mastering the craft, not that I don't think anybody can ever truly master it, in terms of approaching something, you know, readable, I think that was the first time that I really gave it a true shot.
Yeah.
Your wife must be quite an adventurer for her to suggest a trip like that.
I called her bluff, and then she called mine. I thought if I agreed to it, she would change her mind. I was terrified. It was all her. I mean, and honestly, if it was up to her, we'd probably still be out there. But she got pregnant with our first child. We have two great kids, but that first one, she said, well, let's just stay on the road. I said, no, I think I'd like you to have the same doctor for each checkup. And we were free camping on, you know, like Bureau of Land Management land and National Forest. I mean, we were way out there. And I said, what if something happens? You know, you go into labor and we're 2 hours from a hospital, you know, and So anyway, I talked her into coming back to civilization a little bit. But we still have that itch, man. And yeah, I think as the kids get a little older, we might explore doing some summers in the RV. Yeah. But
wow, that's such a great story.
A lot of fun, you know.
Some of the genres that you write in, and sometimes I think it's across all three: Southern Gothic, historical, and Western. Would you just take a moment for readers who maybe don't quite know Southern Gothic? What does that mean, and what would they expect to discover in a book that is written in that genre?
Yeah, to me, the reason I'm drawn to that genre is because it reminds me so much of the Western. Growing up in East Texas, we really were kind of like right on that dividing line between the Southeast and the Southwest. Like East Texas to me feels more like Alabama than it does to the rest of Texas, because you've got the pine trees and the swamps, and it just culturally, you know, it's more like the South with the capital S. And so growing up, I read a lot of Faulkner and a lot of Mark Twain and Flannery O'Connor. And I always felt like those Southern Gothic type of novels, they were always going to have some naturalism in it. They were going to, like y'all talked about, they were going to be really heavy on setting. They're going to be really heavy on kind of the raw dialogue of rural folks, the way we talk and the jargon that we get into and kind of what our beliefs are and aren't and all those things. But then the Southern Gothic does something pretty neat where it kind of borrows small elements from the Western in terms of the ruralness, in terms of having a problem that exists kind of outside of society and that has a solution that needs to come from outside of society. And then also, you know, the emphasis on nature, but then it also borrows from like horror elements a little bit, you know, and so that you kind of get a little spooky vibes every now and then, and a little bit of this biblical language kind of that Cormac McCarthy did in his, you know, Tennessee period and all that. And so, I just always was fascinated by it, but also fascinated by the Western. And when it came to choose what I wanted to write, I couldn't make a choice. And so I just wrote them both.
Yeah. I know you have a question.
When do you write? Do you have a specific schedule? Are you, you get up 3 a.m, 4 a.m, 5 a.m, write for 3 or 4 hours, and you sleep into noon and write a little.
Yo, I used to have the most beautiful, perfect writing schedule in the history of the world, and then I had 2 kids, and now that's all just gone to heck. No, I write whenever I can. You know, with the kids, as they get older, like my daughter's in school now, and so she's gone during the day. And so, like, when my son naps, that's a great time to write. I work at Texas State in San Marcos, Texas State University, and teach some classes up there. And so between classes or during my office hours, it all really is just, I mean, I was at Sonic the other day getting kids' meals for my kids, and it was taking a little while. And so I flipped out my notebook and started writing. It just whenever you can get it in nowadays. And of course, you know, now that I have this fellowship, I've had a lot of extra time. So I've been more productive in the last couple months than I have probably in the last couple years. It nags at me a little bit just because when I first started out, I had so much time every day to write. And so I never felt like pressured or behind deadlines. And now it feels like that's all it is. It's just trying to catch up and keep up. Yeah. But I've found that if, you know, in terms of waiting for that perfect moment or having to get everything just right, you know, I don't have that luxury anymore. So I just have to get it in when I can.
Yeah. Do you read the genres that you write in?
I do. I do. I read across genres a little bit, but not much. Basically what I read is Westerns, Southern Gothic, literary fiction. You know, if it won the Booker Prize or National Book Award, I'll pick it up just to see, you know, kind of what is out there right now. But other than that, I read a lot of nonfiction. I love reading history books. I love reading science books to the extent that I can understand them. You know, I'm trying to learn, you know, all Neil deGrasse Tyson's astrophysics for dummies type stuff. And I'm like, well, hey, that sounds like me. I read just about everything that comes out in the Southern Gothic and Western world just because I have so much reverence for those genres, you know, and I love this stuff that's being written. Of course, I'm partial to the old stuff. I always tell people that all my favorite writers are dead, but I think we got a new good crop. We might be entering a new golden age.
So you don't necessarily take a red pen and cross things out. No, this is not right. You know,
you're able to just read it.
When you are a writer, I do think you read differently, but I never get hung up on like what I would have done in a novel or something. I think maybe in part because it's kind of annoying if somebody does that to you. It's like, listen, you know, somebody will say, well, if I had been writing this book, I would have made this character do this. Yeah. And I'm going, well, you wouldn't have been writing this book. You would have been writing a completely different book, you know? And so, I try not to get hung up on that. And I'm pretty good at suspending disbelief and just rolling with whatever the author puts out and not questioning it.
Yeah. We're going to step away, James, for just a moment and ask this question. Are you a writer? Our sponsors, Blue Cottage Agency and Clicks by Madison, are standing by to assist you. And here's a special offer created just for you. And when we come back, we have a very short piece of music, and then our special guest, James Wade, will read from Narrow the Road. So don't go away. We'll be right back. Authors, welcome home. Every author needs a website, a home base for their brand. Professionally showcase your books and brand with a custom website landing page, starting at $369. Bluebookshelf.com. It's a great feeling to be home. Contact the Blue Cottage team today to get started.
Now my son's old man, well, he's a hard one to know. He's lived for words and music, and they've chased him down the road. And he barely speaks at all about the debt of love he owes. My son's old man, he's a hard one to know. So my old man and my son's old man, like father, like son, a hard one to know.
Welcome back to Rendezvous with a Writer. We're talking to James Wade about his book, Narrow the Road. You have just listened to one of the great Texas songwriters and singers, Alan Chapman. And his song, Old Man's a Hard Man
hard,
to Know.
Hard one to know from his album, Under Blue Skies. James, when I got into this book, so often music just comes into my mind, just because we have a vast love and a long love for Western music. And I just kept hearing Alan's, I didn't hear the whole song, I just kept hearing the son and the father and a hard one to know. And I thank you for, we just felt we needed to share this song of Alan's.
It fits in with the story.
It fits in perfectly. I mean, it really does.
You know, I even asked Alan one time, I said, is your old man a hard man to know? He says, yeah, I think he was.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I don't know if mine was a hard one to know, but he wasn't easy to know.
Yeah, there we go. I think you and me are the same, Jim.
So I believe you're going to read a passage from Narrow the Road. Would you like to do that now?
Yeah, I'm going to read from the prologue for two reasons. One, it doesn't have to have any setup. And two, it's very short. And I don't know, something about writers reading their own work. I still am not used to it, even after five books and however many years. But but I'll read from the prologue and do my best to do it justice. Here he comes, this boy. And what to make of him? A gawky, spindle-shanked creature, fair hair and fair skin, set about with freckles and knobbed knees and big green doe eyes. And at least the young fella has boots. Endicott Johnson, by the looks of them, a good, strong leather. Much finer wear than his ragtag jeans and soiled cotton shirt. Canvas sack tied to a cane pole and resting there on his sharp bone of a shoulder. Wayward young wanderer, alone against the enormity of being. But on he comes, ever forward through the trees, through blue and blackjack oaks, over grasses and forbs, and beneath great willows in their eternal weeping. On he comes. A young person in a dying land, dying time. War and rumors of war, pandemics and economic woes, and what option is left to him but to keep at the path, unforgiving though it may be. Here he is, this boy, made up like the rest of us from that first whit of calcium, what came spilling forth from the cosmos, fleeing the last gasp of dying stars in that time before time, abandoning their elemental hosts so that a new form might come barreling into existence. Vestiges of forgotten galaxies turned energy ripe for creation. And what does he want if not some answer for it all? Some reckoning for the pain. He wouldn't mind the hurt, no. Wouldn't hold it against the hand that engenders infinity so long as it's purposed, so long as it's just. And where might he turn to quiet the great dread? Fear rattling bone and spirit alike. Might he pray? Seek out some temporary stillness bought by veridity and superstition? Well, bless him then. Bless us all, because it won't be silenced. It can't be. Such terror, such wonder. And there now he passes, one and the same. Look at him. Closer. There might be something to him yet, some sort of grit, and he'll need it, won't he? Traveler upon this cursed and thankless path, pilgrim of the one true passage, ever forward. Listen close, friend. Can you hear it? You know that rhythm. You can feel it beating. Withered and worn, but still this boy's heart beats as if it were your own. Even as you shake your head, his heart is your own. Thank y'all.
You know, James, I read a prologue and then I read it again and then I told myself I'm in trouble, because the rest of the book goes like this. It's going to take me a long time to read it, because you have to think on every other sentence. You know?
we pull back from the prologue a little bit, you know, and let the story get rolling.
Does he have grit? Yes. Is he, you know, are we going to follow him? Yes. Let's get into in depth a little bit. Sure. There are so many layers. Definitely, this is a journey story. You might think of, Odysseus and his trip trying to get home, or you might think of Moses going, you know, through the desert, or any kind of an odyssey sort of a story. That is there in James's incomparable way of taking us on that trip. But there are other side stories that he blends in. For instance, the backstory, the veterans benefit backstory.
Yeah. What about?
We were clueless. So I'm going to assume a lot of our listeners are clueless. Would you just take a moment and talk about that story?
Yeah, this was one of the key cornerstones to this novel was William's father, Thomas, and his experience in World War I, and then maybe even more importantly, his experience when he got home. I imagine these folks, they go, they fight in what is the just craziest war ever fought at that time. You know, it's so different than any other war. And then they get home and they learn that, you know, their family member is dead from influenza, you know, like all these different things. And then you've got just a few years later, the Great Depression. And so these guys are really, really struggling. And there was not a VA set up at the time. This was like the first, you know, PTSD was not even an acronym, because we didn't, you know, it didn't exist. And so anyway, all of these things kind of come to a head during the Great Depression, when the veterans start to demand their war bonds. Basically, the government was holding this money that they were going to pay them for having fought in the war, but they were going to pay it to them in the future. And they said, well, listen, we don't want to wait. We don't care if it'll be worth more in 10 years. We need it now. Our families are suffering. And so, so veterans from all over the country, they all traveled to Washington, D.C. To protest and to kind of demand the release of their bonds. And it was so unlike what I think of when I think of a modern protest where it's just people marching in the streets or, you know, something like that. These folks brought their families, you know, they had traveled for weeks, you know, maybe to be there. And they set up these camps all around the Capitol and the swamps of D.C. And they stayed there, you know, for weeks at a time. And they lobbied senators and representatives and they would still march and everything in the streets. But they set up churches. They set up, you know, ball fields for the kids to play. Mm-hmm. I mean, this was something that they were wholly invested in because this was going to make or break them, basically. And when things didn't go their way in the vote, it got, you know, pretty nasty. And the government used its own police force against its veterans, and two veterans were killed. And that was a really, really big indictment, you know, on the Hoover administration at the time. Not that they were popular. I mean, it was the middle of the Great Depression, and even though, and I mentioned it in the book, FDR was not president, but everybody already assumed that he was going to be. And so anyway, all of that was something just like you guys, I didn't know any of that. I didn't know any of that story. And so when I came across it, I was just fascinated and I wanted to get it into the novel as best I could. And that's actually how William's father came to have this journal that William is given. And we get to read about these things it kind of from the perspective of someone who was there. And so I really, you know, I appreciated the opportunity to bring that piece of history into the novel.
Yeah, it's so important to the story.
It's interesting. We could talk a little bit about Thomas because he's like on a crusade. Mm-hmm. You know, he's there. He didn't want to go and enlist and serve in the war, which none of his family was interested in doing that. So then he came back, and he's in part of this. He's part of the organization of putting this thing together. It fails, but he doesn't stop, does he? He keeps going,
and he carries.
Yeah. He carries so much guilt from being. So another fascinating thing is World War One was the last time that we let basically everybody from one area be in the same like unit or platoon. You know, the thinking in changing it being that like, well, let's say these folks get wiped out. Well, now we've really crippled like an entire town's, you know, like a generation for an entire town. But at the time, it was thought, well, you'll fight harder if you're there with your actual friends and all this stuff. And so we also allowed back then we would allow these units to select their own, you know, captains. And so Thomas was picked and he basically, you know, when someone would be killed in war or when someone would take their own life after the war, he felt very responsible for that. And so then for him to put so much effort into this this attempt to get the folks their war bonds and then see it fail as well, he's just that was kind of the last straw for him. And it just really crippled his confidence and it really tested his faith. And so he's going through this loss of faith, this anger at both the government and this anger at kind of everything that he's ever known that he thought was right is he's questioning it because he feels so guilty and so angry and so depressed. And he's really fighting all of these demons, which William doesn't know anything about until he comes across the journal. And so I thought that was important kind of for William and for the reader to see that, is Thomas being a good father by abandoning his family? No, of course he's not. But he does kind of have in his own mind this reason why he can't be around them. He thinks he's going to infect them, basically, right? Like he was raised very Christian and he was a very faith-based man. And so the thought that he's lacking in that faith, he thinks it's going to somehow, you know, infect his wife, who is a very faithful Christian. It's going to infect his son, you know, and so he's trying to stay away from them until he can figure it out for himself. And so anyway, just a little sympathy for the father figure, which is not something I typically do in my novels. Anybody that's read them, I'm usually pretty hard on the fathers. But I wanted to give Thomas a little bit of grace because he had just been through so much.
Yeah.
We kind of noticed that. I saw that in a couple other books. Even though we hadn't read any other books, I read some reviews of your novels.
Yeah.
I said, the guy takes, the dad takes a big beating here.
A hard one to know.
That's right. Yeah. A hard one to live with.
So we understand Thomas is away from the family. Now we have William. Mm-hmm. And William is going to go looking for him. And so he's going to go off on a journey. He has a letter, right? He sort of knows where he thinks his dad might be. And he takes a friend, Ollie, along with him. What a partnership the two of them have. Ollie has you laughing and smiling, and he's just such an optimist, isn't he? I mean, Ollie just keeps... keeps the story moving along, and William, for
a young guy, he's quite a philosopher.
Yeah, you know? and William is not that he's a depressed character. William, they look to William for where are we going next, and what are we doing next? You know, he's sort of like his dad. He's a bit of somebody that's comfortable being in charge. The two of them are just so delightful, and then you introduce Lena. Oh my goodness.
Anybody particular Lena is modeled after? You know anybody like her?
You know, it's not anybody in particular, but it is kind of in general. I wanted Lena to be a stand-in for just basically the how many capable women I know that save guys' asses all the time.
That's Lena. You know,
my wife saves my butt all the time. You know, there have just been so many wonderful women over the years in my life that have pointed me in the right direction and that have just been more than capable and that don't always get the credit for it. And so I wanted these boys to be in awe of how amazing this young lady is at survival skills, at decision making, you know, at driving a boat, you know, when they can't. I mean, it just she really comes in and becomes this wonderful get for them because without her, I don't think they make it. Probably
no,
they wouldn't.
You know, the first 100 pages.
No, they wouldn't have made it without her.
She's got their six or she's got their back or whatever.
That's right.
And it's wonderful.
That's right.
The situations that you put these characters in, this landscape, you know, we're not hikers. We're not adventurers. I wouldn't say we're city guys and gals, but we're definitely not these characters. You know, James, sometimes I had to go and look up what's a Ballygall? What's a, you know, what kind of a plant? Where are they? And so it was so interesting, this landscape, which is like a character. I mean, this landscape that they go through. I am looking at the clock, but just take a moment and just give us a little bit about the landscape.
Sure,
if you can.
Sure.
And then we're gonna
growing up in East Texas, this is very much the landscape that I grew up in. You know, hunted and fished in, and I very much believe in naturalism as my writing style. It's what I like to read. And I think that setting as a character is important. I think you can set the whole tone of a novel, by giving it, you know, giving readers a good lay of the land and explaining the weather, the flora, the fauna, all of these things so that when you do start to build characters, the world that they're in is already established, you know? And so I wanted, It's no coincidence that as the kids get further into the thicket and further essentially into the plot, you know, everything starts to constrict and it feels claustrophobic, you know, and all of these things. And I think you can use landscape that way and you can use weather that way and you can use water as a purifying source and you can use, if you're out in the West, like Larry McMurtry said, you know, your sentences need to be spare as the landscape, but we were in East Texas where everything was lush. So I want, you know, get the sentences lush and almost overgrown feeling, you know? So yeah, I base all of my novels basically around the landscape and then fill them in from there.
Yeah.
Well, I tell you, you're successful. You know, I thought if I was in that jungle, I'd be getting claustrophobia and thinking, will I ever get out of here?
And I'm no Lena. I'm no Lena. So, you know.
Then I'm in trouble, right?
We're in trouble. We're going to step away for one more quick moment. And we're going to tell you about one of the places that you can find the books of many of our authors, including James Wade's books. And that's our Out West Shop affiliate page on bookshop.org. When we come back, another little piece of music and more with James. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Story is everything. Find a great one on Out West Shop's bookshop. Go to outwestshop.com, find books and CDs on the menu, choose Shop Out West on bookshop.org. Browse through featured authors on Rendezvous with a Writer. Explore curated book lists and our featured picks. Add in note cards, calendars, and jigsaw puzzles. One-stop shopping for great gifts. Use the search box to find thousands more titles. Make the switch. Your purchase supports us as independent booksellers. That's our...
As I walked out one morning for pleasure, I met a cowpuncher come riding along. His hat was thrown back, and his spurs was a-jingling as he approached me a-singing his song. Whoop-a-tie-yi-yo, get along, you little dogies, it's your misfortune and none of my own. Whoop-a-tie-yi-yo, get along, you little dogies, for you know Wyoming will be a new home. Your mama, she was raised way down in Texas, where the Jimson weed and the sandburrs grow. Raised you up on prickly pear and coyon, now we'll throw you on the road to Idaho. Early in the spring we round up the dogies, mark them and brand them and bob off their tails. Round up the horses, load up the chuck wagon and throw the dogies up on the trail. It's hooping and yelling and driving those dogies, oh how I wish that you would go on. It's hooping and yelling and gone, you little dogies, for you know Wyoming will be a new home.
We're talking with James Wade, and that's a John Lomax song, right? That takes us back to the old days in Texas,
yeah,
right?
That's a classic, Get Along, Little Dogies. And although there are no cowboys in this book, you do mention, James, you have William thinking about maybe going west and liking music of the western. And it, in my mind, like, that's such a classic, and it would have been out there in the 1930s. He would have known it. So there's our little tip to get along, little dogies. Well, all right, let's move. We are going to be fast.
Do we have time for questions?
Yes. Well, let's ask that important one that you love to ask.
Which we asked the other night. You know, we know, James, you get control of these folks, and you got some different type of people, their characters in your stories. But do they ever surprise you?
You know, this is the boring answer, but not really. I've heard writers talk about how their characters take control of books and they demand this and that. And I've never felt that way with characters. I just try to make them fit with the other voices that are in my head. Because a lot of times I'll have a character in my head and I'll realize that it's not on the page. He or she is not matching up, you know, with uh-huh. what's in my mind, and I have to kind of tweak it a little bit to what I'm seeing. But no, I don't let them run around all willy-nilly. They got to do what I see.
All right.
That's a good one. What would you like a reader to take away from this book?
You know, I think that's probably the best and hardest question that I ever get asked about any book, because on the one hand, and again, this, I don't know if this is the popular answer, but I don't care what they take away. I write these books for me and not for them. You know, if I started caring what readers or critics or anybody else thought, I think I'd lose my damn mind. You know, it's hard enough when you've got publishers and editors and everybody else. And so I write for me and tell the stories that I want to tell. But with that being said, I think if I wanted a reader to take anything away, it would just be to ask questions of themselves. Mm-hmm. I'm not trying to change anybody's beliefs, systems, or anything like that. Yeah. But through reading, we really can become more empathetic people. I think that there's, I think there's no coincidence that as the amount of readers in this country has gone down, as our reading level has gone down, it's like a sixth grade level now. The number of people, especially men, that read novels has gone down to historic lows. I think it's no coincidence that our empathy levels are also at historic lows. Yeah. I mean, you get on the internet and see what people just say about one another and what our politicians say about one another. And there's just this lack of love and empathy that I really think you can gain from novels. And so I try to, when I write, I try to, you know, even my bad characters, even my antagonists usually have some kind of either redeeming qualities
or
some kind of backstory that might explain how they got to where they are. And and so, yeah, I would just say I would hope readers would at least question just kind of the way that, you know, that they view the world a little bit and hopefully come away with a little more empathy for it.
So where can people find you, follow you, and get your books?
You can follow me on Instagram at James Wade Ryder. You can find me online, jameswaderyder.com. And then as far as getting the books, man, I would love it if you'd go to your local bookstore, and if they don't have it, ask them to order it. If you can't do that, or if you don't have a local bookstore, bookshop.org, which you saw the ad spot for earlier, that supports local bookstores. You can just order straight from it, or you can go in and type in a bookstore and have your support go to that bookstore. And then if you absolutely have to, you know, maybe Barnes and Noble or Amazon or something like that. But I would hope local bookstore or bookshop.org.
Yeah.
I want my money when I buy books to go to buying somebody's daughter some soccer cleats. I don't want it going to some billionaire who's building rockets to go into space. Anyway, that's it.
Jim, do you have a quote?
I am looking at quotes.
Time now, James. I hope you had a good time, James. Did you?
Y'all
are
wonderful, guys. I can't thank you enough for having me on.
This is so fun. I can't wait to read more and have you back.
Oh, all anytime.
Right. We got time for a couple, right? I got two short ones here. This is from Matthew 7:14, and it's in the front of the book. But small is the gate and narrow the road that leads to life, and only a few find it.
Yeah.
And then our fun characters, Lily and Ollie, are talking. And Lily's kind of a humorous,
yeah,
you know.
Ollie.
It's been raining a lot, and then it stopped raining. And the last several weeks have been dry as a bone. The crops are all dying. And Ollie says, tough times to be growing anything at all, really. And he said, I mean, even the jackrabbits are carrying a canteen.
Ollie always brings a little levity to the conversation.
Yes, ma'am.
Well, we want to thank you so much, James, for being with us tonight. Mm-hmm. This has just been great fun. We want to thank Sam Hassan of LA Talk Radio, who played DJ again tonight. Sam, thank you. Mm-hmm. We want to thank, of course, Blue Cottage Agency and Clicks by Madison. If you follow us on Instagram and Facebook, those are Janelle's fabulous graphics that she puts together for us. We want to thank Alan Chapman for providing music tonight, along with the Hot Texas Swing Band. Next week, we will have author Sherry Roberts here with us, and we'll be actually talking about two books. The second book is on its way, brand new, and we'll have it for next week. But the first one, Just Call Me Partner, and the second one is Just Look at My Boots. And it'll be great fun to have Sherry with us. And do you have any closing thoughts, Jim?
You know, as we always say, it's always a great day out west.
Keep writing.
And we'll keep reading.
And we'll keep reading.
We want to thank you, James. It's been a lot of fun. We appreciate everything you had to say.
And well, I appreciate y'all. Y'all are wonderful. Thank y'all.
We're going to have you back, James. We'll get that calendar out.
I love it.
See you next week, everybody. Thank you so much. Follow us. 176 episode. Get it again. Have a good night.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.